Good afternoon, you're listening to KFSK News for Friday, August 14th. I'm Taylor Heckert. Petersburg's annual Pedal Paddle Battle, a fundraiser for the Petersburg Medical Center Foundation, raised $25,000 when it was held on August 8th. That's the most the event has ever raised. The Petersburg Medical Center Foundation helps provide scholarships for hospital staff and high schoolers going into the medical field. Sue Paulson is the foundation president.
We're so excited and so grateful because this has really filled the coffers. And when people say they would like to continue their studies and become a registered nurse, we can say, yes, we would love to help with your tuition.
Paulson says last year, the foundation was able to give 5 scholarships to high school students. During the Pedal Paddle Battle, participants bike and kayak from Scow Bay, about 3 miles south of town, to Sandy Beach. Participants are encouraged to find sponsors and collect donations for the event. Individual participants raised $6,500 this year, and the remaining money came from corporate sponsors. With Alaska's primary election on Tuesday, money is pouring into Alaska's U.S. Senate race, and not just for the 2 candidates running multi-million dollar campaigns. Pop-up political groups have also spent more than $2 million to support fringe candidates and political unknowns, some who've never lived in the state. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin explains what's going on here, and it's far from straightforward.
Richard Grayson says he knows flyers with his face and name on them are filling mailboxes around Alaska. But he doesn't get them. He lives in Arizona. A retired law school administrator originally from Brooklyn, he runs for office in all sorts of states. He says he likes seeing his name on the candidate list. He likes it when reporters call.
Egotism? I don't know. Curiosity. If you look me up, you see I've been doing this since 1979.
He's amused that a group called Fair Deal Alaska has spent about $800,000 to promote him and another non-Alaskan perennial candidate, Democrat Carol Hafner. Fair Deal even has a digital ad promoting Grayson.
Richard Grayson is the progressive fighter we need in Washington.
Grayson is delighted.
It was an ego trip to see an actual, commercial.
But Grayson knows he's a pawn in someone else's false flag operation. Because with control of the U.S. Senate at stake, people around the country are investing in Alaska's race, hoping to rack a win for their team. And some of the groups are trying to game Alaska's unique election system. Fair Deal hasn't had to reveal its funding sources yet, but whoever is behind it is hoping Grayson and Hafner will be among the top 4 finishers in the primary and advance to the general election ballot, along with incumbent Republican Senator Dan Sullivan and Democrat Mary Peltola. Anchorage political consultant Jim Lotzfeld says Fair Deal Alaska is trying to boost Sullivan's chances by getting 2 candidates on the ballot who might draw progressive votes away from Peltola. He says it's a tactic groups on both sides are playing.
Depending what comprises that top 4, people feel like it can affect an election.
On the other side, a group called Right for Alaska is promoting Palmer Republican Gerald Heikes, with ads saying he's more fiercely opposed to abortion than Sullivan is.
He's done watching woke politicians forget Alaska. That ends now. Vote Gerald Heikes for U.S. Senate by August 18th.
Right for Alaska has spent more than $1 million on the race. It would seem to be a conservative group, but follow the money. Right for Alaska has listed 1 funder so far. William Harris of Lexington, Massachusetts, gave $100,000. Harris is a big contributor to Democratic candidates who support abortion rights. Heikes did not respond to a voicemail message. Alaska's ranked choice voting system for the general election would tend to blunt the impact of these false flag operations. A conservative voter, for instance, might choose Heikes and also rank other Republicans, so the vote would accrue to whichever one was in the lead. But some voters don't rank or don't rank one of the leading candidates. And Lotzfeld says those are the votes these operations on the right and left are aimed at.
It means they have too much money. Like, they're just like, what about this crazy idea? Yeah, we can fund that. That's what's going on.
The pop-up super PACs behind these efforts can spend unlimited funds but aren't allowed to coordinate with the candidates. As for Grayson, the Green Party candidate in Arizona, he doesn't think he'll finish in the top four of the primary, even with all the promotion. And he says he wants Peltola to win. So if he did advance to the general election, he says he'd do what he could to help her.
If I were on the ballot, I would just tell people and have her tell people, I support her, don't vote for me.
No matter how many or how few votes Grayson gets, Alaskans will probably see his name on future ballots. He says it's easy to become a candidate in Alaska because you don't need to gather signatures and the filing fee is just $100. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A Petersburg man is being charged with five felonies after police say they found methamphetamine, fentanyl, and guns in his car. According to police reports, Alaska Wildlife Trooper Cody Litster conducted a traffic stop on 32-year-old Corey Drew Wilson on August 5th. After smelling alcohol, Litster asked Wilson to step out of the car, and a small Ziploc fell onto the ground. Local police officers also responded and say the contents in the bag tested positive for 5 grams of meth. Police say Wilson told them he had two guns behind his driver's seat. After receiving a search warrant, officers say they found 17 more grams of meth, 6 grams of fentanyl, along with a digital scale in his car. They also found a third gun in his car. Petersburg police say the approximate combined value of the drugs could be between $8,000 and $12,000. Wilson is being charged with two felonies involving a controlled substance and three felonies for weapons misconduct. His public defender did not immediately respond to calls and emails requesting comment. His preliminary hearing is today. Crab populations in the Bering Sea are struggling, and researchers say climate change is a big cause. A new tool described in a study published last week will help researchers predict one of climate change's biggest threats to crabs, ocean acidity. As KMXT's Catherine Irving reports, the study's authors hope their work can help crabbers and fishery managers.
The study was published earlier this month in the Journal of Geophysical Research Oceans. Darren Pilcher is the study's lead author and an oceanographer at the University of Washington. He says he started the study because of requests from fisheries stakeholders. The ocean absorbs a quarter of our carbon emissions, which make the water more acidic when the two mix. Acidic conditions are harmful for many different animals. Pilcher says that's especially true for shellfish, like crabs.
They can eat more and that kind of helps a little bit. But that only helps to a certain point. And in fact, in some of the previous experiments with red king crab, like if you lower the pH to a value of 7.5, the crab just die.
Scientists have pointed to factors from climate change, like ocean acidification, as the reason the number of Bristol Bay red king crabs has plummeted in recent years. Jamie Goen is the executive director of Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers, a nonprofit trade association. She says that other species, like snow crab, have also tanked.
When I started this job 8 years ago, we had 60 vessels in the fleet, but obviously with the collapse of snow crab and the closure of red king crab, we're down to 40 active vessels right now.
Pilcher and his team wanted to help the fishery by creating a tool that could forecast acidity in the Bering Sea. Ocean acidity doesn't exist in a vacuum, so the first step was to make a computer model of the entire Bering Sea, recreating the water conditions at any given time. They put a lot of existing data into their model on ocean conditions over time, measuring things like temperature, currents, and distribution of phytoplankton. Then they added in ocean acidity data collected from the region and tested their new tool by having it forecast the acidity of the Bering Sea over a roughly 40-year period. They compared that forecast to what actually happened each year. Pilcher says they also compared their new tool to a simple baseline model, which predicts that conditions at the beginning of the year will stay the same throughout the year.
It's actually a really good forecast for the ocean because the ocean doesn't really change that quickly.
They tested both models for both the bottom and surface of the ocean. Pilcher found that they were both equally good at predicting acidity at the bottom of the ocean, but he says their new model did a lot better at predicting surface temperatures than the baseline one.
It kind of makes sense because the bottom waters, especially during the summer, are more cut off from the atmosphere, whereas, of course, the surface is still very connected to the atmosphere and is responding to it on a quicker time frame.
Pilcher says he hopes the information from their experiment and his new model can inform future management.
So we could say, hey, this is what we're predicting for the upcoming summer so that we can give everybody a little bit advance notice if there are, say, worse acidification conditions.
He says they've also discussed partnering with a new king crab mariculture project happening on St. Paul Island. The plan is to raise baby Bristol Bay red king crabs in a lab and release them back into Bristol Bay when they reach a certain size. But because juvenile crabs are more vulnerable to ocean acidity than adults, Goen says Pilcher's model could provide important data.
Where I could see an immediate benefit is, you know, knowing, are those waters going to be unusually acidic or higher temperatures in a given year? And then maybe that's not the best year to put some brood stock back into Bristol Bay.
Goen says she hopes for more research on the changing ocean chemistry in the Bering Sea so fishermen can make informed decisions. But for now, she says Pilcher's results are very promising. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Catherine Irving.
For the past two summers, a bar in Sitka has acted as a makeshift gallery for a local artist who has recently won a prestigious international award for his work. KCAW's Lauren Salemo met with the painter to learn more about the stories he wants to preserve.
Stephen Laurie sits at a booth in the Pioneer Bar in Sitka and points to a painting behind the counter. It's a portrait of Art Petreborg, whose windswept white hair whisks across a canvas filled with dark clouds.
He's got braided sideburns. Are you kidding me? I mean, that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
The two met nearly 50 years ago when Laurie started trolling, and he still remembers their first interaction. Laurie's 30-some paintings hanging in the bar look to capture these types of stories. The collection is called This Thing We Call the Ocean, Part 2, Names Discovered, Stories Told. It's similar to last summer's exhibit, in name and content, but this time it also honors some people from the past.
They're no longer with us, but they formed the sort of the core, or that they set the tone for fishing in Pelican and in Sitka.
A downtown bar might not be a traditional gallery space, but Laurie prefers it that way.
This is where ordinary people come, and that's the audience that I'm interested in.
Earlier this summer, Laurie accepted the People's Choice Award for one of New Zealand's most prestigious painted portraiture competitions. He was recognized by the New Zealand Portrait Gallery for a painting of him and his sons aboard the fishing vessel Born Again. It hangs with his other works at the Pioneer Bar. The bar's walls are typically covered in small, framed photographs of fishermen, their boats, and the ocean, but Maite Lorente, who helped Laurie curate this collection, says there comes a time when you start to ignore the photos.
If you want to see a work of art that you have in your place, or you really want to see it, once time has gone by, you need to move it, you need to shake it. When we remove these paintings, those stories come back with a louder voice.
Laurie's paintings help bring a new perspective.
It feels different.
Yeah.
Nor better, nor worse, but different.
Lorente helped Laurie find stories and family photos for him to paint, though the artist seems to know quite a few of his subjects.
Jake Phillips here, he was so kind to me when he could have been really tough on me.
Laurie says he admires how fishermen would help one another, even when they didn't have to. He knows fishing is a stressful job. He was a troller for 43 years, but he wants to capture the lightness of his subjects, not just their grit.
Painting someone like Moses Johnson Sr. there, you know, that guy was one of the best fishermen in this town, but really just totally low-key and not at all pushy, or, you know, he was a really mellow guy. His biggest thing was his basketball when he was a young man, but he caught fish like crazy.
There's a portrait of Bill Hills, a name Lorente came across when researching Greentop Harbor on Jacoby Island, not far from Pelican. Hill started fishing in Alaska in the late 1930s.
We're not talking about float planes or Coast Guard helicopters or any of that. You're on your own, you know, and so it becomes a community of people keeping an eye on your neighbor. Even if he cuts you off every now and again, you're still keeping an eye on him.
Laurie remembers a time when there'd be picnics on the beach if fishing was slow. He says the shortened fishing season has made the job more competitive over the years, and he hopes his paintings are a reminder of how essential a close-knit community is to fishing in Southeast. In Sitka, I'm Lauren Salemo.
For Canvas K, I'm Taylor Hackert.